You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show, which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us on Perspectives this afternoon are Nina and Sel Litvak. And they are the producers and directors of a movie called Saving Lincoln. Now, is that right, Sel and Nina, producer-director?
Yeah, well, we're a screenwriting team. Nina and I write together. I am one of the producers of the film, along with my partner, Ruben Lim, and I'm also the director.
As far as Saving Lincoln, for people who have not seen the movie or the trailer, because you can watch the trailer online, and if you're on Facebook, I'm not sure how you could have missed it. But basically, it's a story about two friends. That is President Lincoln and his personal friend and self-appointed bodyguard, Ward Hill Lamon. And he was actually one of President Lincoln's attorney's partners, because his main partner was William Herndon. And, of course, everyone has heard the stories of William Herndon and how later on, and actually in 1866, he came out with a book about President Lincoln and the fact that there were some things that the public did not like, and especially a year after the president had been slain. And with that set up, let's talk a little bit about why did you all decide to take this project on as far as, or did you already know that this other Lincoln movie was coming out?
Well, we started a long time ago, long before there was that movie, almost 13 years ago, in fact, or about 12 years ago. And at that time, there just hadn't been a Lincoln movie in decades. And we were looking for our next project. Nina has had a lifelong fascination with Abraham Lincoln that she can tell you about, and he's definitely always been a hero of mine. And, you know, and we just looked out into sort of the cultural landscape and said, why is there no Lincoln movie? That should be the great American movie. It had been done as a miniseries in the 80s, but to look at a feature film telling the story of Abraham Lincoln leading the nation through the Civil War, you have to go all the way back to 1930 when D.W. Griffith did it. So we said, okay, I mean, here's a story that needs to be told, that must be told, done in a proper way for a feature film. And, you know, you don't just dash off a Lincoln script when you have a long weekend.
No, you don't.
So Nina and I really dove into that. He's the second most written about human being. And while we didn't read all the books, we really read as many as we possibly could, developed some favorites, developed a real visual approach to telling the story, because the problem with any Lincoln movie is there's just so much information. You need a limiter. You need something to limit what you're doing.
You need an angle.
So at that time, what we came up with is that Lincoln's hat, that script was called Lincoln's Hat, and his hat would be in every scene, even if Abraham Lincoln wasn't. It was really about a kind of a mystery. Why would such a tall man wear such a tall hat? You know, it's known that he carried his papers in it, sort of his secrets in it. And it was kind of a way to get at his character. We worked on that script for 2 years, and just as it was done, all the drafts were completed. Our agent was showing it around town. It was definitely sparking some interest. And it was going to go up, you know, sort of for sale to the studios on a Friday. And so this is after 2 years of work, and on that Wednesday, Steven Spielberg announced he's making an Abraham Lincoln movie. He's got Doris Kearns Goodwin's book. At that time, Tom Hanks was attached to star, and Lincoln's hat died. I mean, it was pretty much an instant death, and no one would even read it. Certainly no one would be insane enough to go up against Steven Spielberg with a Lincoln movie. And that was very painful for us, very frustrating, and we just finally had to lick our wounds and go off and do other things.
Doesn't sound like a very good segment as far as segging into this, but you just said that was the death of Lincoln's hat. And basically, people are wondering, why did this president have to die? Where was his bodyguard? And people are not aware that back then they did not have a Secret Service. They had a Secret Service, but they were for a different reason. It was for counterfeit and the Treasury Department. And this angle that you decided to take about his bodyguard, they wanted to know, okay, where was he the second years? Because the job that he wanted was to be ambassador of France, like Benjamin Franklin. But on that particular night, President Lincoln had allegedly sent Mr. Lamon out to Richmond, Virginia, so he had no bodyguard. Now, what decided to make you take that angle and to show that closeness? Because you see a lot of that in the movie, that they are friends, they kid around, they joke around. Mr. Lincoln, to the frustration of some of his cabinet members, jokes around a lot, doesn't take his life seriously, as you might say. And his bodyguard is very serious. The fact that, look, my job is to take care of you, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And he took that job very seriously. He came from the closest, most intimate, most loving place. He really was the oldest friend that Lincoln had in Washington. He came as a friend, as you mentioned, almost as an entourage. And when the first assassination attempt happened in 1861, on the way to Washington, before Lincoln was even inaugurated, that's when they realized just how big the danger was, and when Lamon stepped into that role and just said, I'm going to be the bodyguard. And so for us to approach the Lincoln story from the point of view of a friend, somebody who knows, nobody knows him better, especially during the Washington years. This is the only friend he brought. He's known Lincoln since 1847.
He spent every single day of the war at Lincoln's side.
He spent every day of the war at Lincoln's side, and he has charged himself and then comes to be accepted as the guy who's charged with the role of keeping Lincoln alive. So it's just a wonderful angle onto the Lincoln story.
Nina, I'm glad you mentioned that as far as you said, keeping Lincoln alive, because in some of those shots, and people don't realize that, you know, today when the president goes visits the troops, there's all kinds of security, etc. But here is President Lincoln on the front lines with, you know, that tall hat. And, you know, what better target is he going to make?
Right. I mean, people don't realize at the beginning of the war, first of all, no president had ever been assassinated. It really was unthinkable for most people. And so there was no Secret Service. There was no security detail assigned to the president. But, you know, as soon as he was elected, basically half the country left. So obviously a lot of people really hated him. And that became clear on the train ride. And one of the episodes we cover in the movie is the Baltimore plot, when there is a gang of armed ruffians who had an elaborate plan to kill Lincoln right there and then on the way to Washington. And that's when Lamon stepped in. And the flip side of that is Lincoln wound up sneaking into Washington in the middle of the night to avoid this plot. And he got to Washington safely, but he also became the butt of every comedian, humorist, writer. I mean, it was the
pundit.
Big joke of his first week that, oh, he was so scared he snuck in the middle of the night. So Lincoln was so humiliated by that he said, I will never again appear frightened in front of the public. I don't ever want to look weak. So he never wanted a bodyguard. He never wanted a security detail or a cavalry unit assigned to him because he always wanted to look brave. And the only one he would tolerate was Lamon because, A, he was his oldest friend and he could trust him, unlike everybody else in Washington who was, you know, he just met them, they want something from him, they're all politicians. Lamon was a dear friend. He knew he could trust him. And Lamon also made himself valuable to Lincoln because he was an entertainer. He was a banjo player and a singer and a joke teller and a court jester. So for those reasons, he was the one guy that Lincoln would allow to be near him. And he was a big, tough, heavily armed bodyguard.
And that's a scene that's documented and described by John Hay, Lincoln's personal secretary. Who described Lamon as sleeping outside Lincoln's bedroom door, in an attitude of dumb fidelity, almost like a pet, you know, like
a puppy dog,
a faithful puppy.
Yeah.
So you know, it's well known that Lincoln struggled with what was then called melancholy and what we would call depression, and there was no medication for it. So to have a guy around who could cheer you up, who you could laugh with. I mean, Lincoln often referred to jokes and laughter as his medicine, as his tonic.
And there was no TV you could turn on, or radio, or anything to entertain. You know, you could read a book, or you could have a friend that was going to make you laugh.
So Lincoln passed through the darkest hours, not only of the nation's history, but of his own history. I mean, the time, the 4 years that he spent in Washington.
Tragic.
I mean, none of us should ever live through things that he lived through and to make the choices that he had to make. I mean, it's well known the Lincolns lost their beloved son, Willie, who was 11 years old in 1862. You don't get over that. Lincoln had to write the orders that sent so many other families' boys to die. He was such a gentle man. And to send all those boys into harm's way, unimaginable numbers. I mean, in a country of 30 million, that over 700,000 perished, it's unthinkable. You know, in a country of 300 million, that would be over 7 million gone. Every family was touched by loss. He sat at the head of it. He had to write the orders that condemned these multitudes. And he was keenly aware of it. They weren't just numbers to him. You know, he felt every loss personally. And that's really what makes Abraham Lincoln so special, how he wrestled and tried to avoid creating those losses, but ultimately had to be courageous enough to make those choices.
And, you know, it was interesting, too, as you mentioned, of course, and there is a book called Lincoln's Melancholy. It's an academic book out there. And there's also one called The Madness of Mary about what she went through. But the fact that he used his humor, he used his stories to break up serious things. But one of the things that, you know, today we have social media, Facebook, we'll get angry at somebody, we'll post something, or we'll write an email and then hit send, and it's gone. What he would do is he would sit down, he would write a letter, he would be angry, but then he would never mail it. He'd put it in his pocket, and then he'd tear it up and throw it away. So he was a very forgiving man, and as you mentioned, Mr. Lemon was very good for him, and that's what I liked about one of the things that I liked about that movie that you guys made is the fact that you added a lot of personality and the fact that, you know, this is the president. They're on their way to Washington, but yet they're having a good time because they're singing songs, Jimmy Crack Corn, you know, and just having a great time. And you're showing the human side of the president.
Yeah, that's what this particular angle we felt enabled us to do, was show his personal side, you know, the man behind the myth.
Now, tell us about the special kind of film this is and the kind of filming that you used, because you used Civil War pictures, correct?
Yes. So we did something very particular. And sort of to round out the story we started to tell earlier, you know, Lincoln's hat went away all those years ago. The years went by. We wanted to make a movie about Lincoln. We never lost our determination. Because that other movie was always out there, no one would help us make ours. So we said, you know what? We're independent filmmakers. We're going to find an independent way to make an Abraham Lincoln movie. It is an epic story. To do that on an independent budget is going to require tremendous creativity. We don't know what the solution is. We're going to find it. So, you know, we came back to it. We found this new angle because the old angle to us, you know, having grown as filmmakers by making our first film, we said, you know what, that was interesting, but we need this human side. Now, we've been talking about this human side, which is Lamon. Okay. In the research that when we renewed our research, I spent countless hours in the online division of the Library of Congress, Prints and Photographs Division, where all the Civil War pictures that you've ever seen are housed. And anybody can see them, anybody can access them. But not only that, they're digitized at incredible high resolution. So you can download them, get in, zoom in, keep zooming in, and see, you know, like 5% of the picture and fill your computer screen with it. And I was always in there looking around at this world that Lincoln and Lamon would occupy as a writer, thinking about, okay, what would these scenes be like? In the back of my mind as a director, thinking, how am I going to do this? How am I going to tell this huge story on an independent budget? And one night, I had that aha moment. You know, I was looking at a scene of soldiers in a hospital. You know, they're recovering from their wounds in a hospital in Washington, D.C. And there's a lot of depth in the picture. And there's, you know, this kid, he looks like he's 18 years old or maybe only 16, very, very thin, emaciated. He's at the back of the room. You look at the picture and as a whole picture, you'd never notice this kid. He's so far back there. When I zoomed all the way in, I could look at him. I was asking myself,
how would this kid respond to a visit by President Lincoln? But what I suddenly saw was, man, the way I'm moving my cursor around this picture, I could move my camera. We could film our movie inside these pictures. You know, movies like Sky Captain, The World of Tomorrow, 300, Sin City, they've made entire movies where they shoot it on a green screen and create the sets and locations digitally afterward. What had never been done is to make a movie that way using vintage photographs as the sets and locations. And I just, you know, brimming with ignorant confidence, I said, we could do it. We're going to find a way to do it. And, of course, it turned out to be much more difficult and challenging than I ever imagined. But we found a way. We stayed with it. We developed a process. I ended up calling it Cinecollage. And you know, it's just the first movie of its kind. All of the actors, you know, we filmed them in a green screen stage. But when you watch the movie, they are literally walking around in the world that Lincoln and Lamon walked around. They are walking around in 1860, surrounded by photographic extras of the period, and the ground and the buildings and the sky and everything you see in the film is of 1860.
And it looks great.
Thank you.
For people who have not seen the movie or the trailer, I mean, and it looks great. And I think that's one of the biggest questions that people have that I've noticed as far as the post on your Facebook page, the fact that people don't understand how this concept worked. And if you wouldn't mind telling us, and it's probably difficult to, if you want to just estimate, about how many pictures did you use or did you go through?
I looked through probably all of them. I suspect I looked at every Civil War picture in the Library of Congress, certainly over 10,000. There are approximately 110 scenes in the movie, 730 shots, and you know, while some scenes were all made out of one photograph, others required multiple photographic elements, you know, to construct the location. I think in the end we probably used about 200 to 300 in the movie.
And you know, it's interesting that you were able to find those pictures because tragically, after the Civil War, people were so tired of it. They didn't want to see any more pictures. They didn't want to see any more blood and gore. That a lot of those plates were sold to greenhouses, and so history
is long
gone.
You've heard that, yeah?
It's awful. Now,
it's unbelievable. Yep.
Tell us a little bit about the acting now, because you mentioned that shortly after you were going to sign, that this was announced, that the other Lincoln movie was coming out. So what about your cast? What about your actors and everybody else? Was it difficult to recruit these people, or did you already have them on board?
No, we figured out the method first, and then there was definitely question marks, you know, around town. Like, what did you say? What are you doing? How are you going to do that? But to their credit, the people in our cast got it, you know, or at least were curious enough about it. So each person came on in a slightly different way. Let's start with Tom Amandus, who plays Abraham Lincoln, wonderful, gifted actor. Everyone has seen him. You might not recognize his name immediately, but he's been on television and movies forever. And what's amazing about Tom is that he's from Illinois, and he just lived, you know, he grew up in this Lincoln culture. People from Illinois, it's almost something a little bit mythic and sacred about it, you know, and his family actually took trips several times in his childhood to Springfield, and this was very serious for him. He took it as the role of a lifetime and prepared for it accordingly. Tom committed so much. I mean, he learned the handwriting. Whenever you see Lincoln writing in our movie, it is Tom himself doing it. He walked around the Lincoln home in Springfield at night, sort of recreating the walk back from the office late at night. He felt like that's when he really got that feeling. And Tom had played Carl Sandburg in the first play that he ever did back in Illinois. And so he was very familiar with the Carl Sandburg biography, which is one of our favorites. And so we really just had tremendous chemistry, you know, he and I as director and actor, and we're just always on the same page. It was a lot of work that we did, but it was very enjoyable because we were always after the same cause, as it were. And then Lee Coco, who plays Ward Hill Lamon, is another fascinating guy who was born in Mississippi. Now, Lamon is from Virginia. The other thing is the president's bodyguard throughout the Civil War was a Southerner. Okay, people forget that. He only went to Illinois when he was 19, and that's when he met Lincoln. But he was definitely a Virginia gentleman. And Lee is from Mississippi and then had been doing Chicago theater for years before he came out to L.A., and this was his first big movie part shortly after he got here. And it was almost impossible to find him because we were looking for a guy who was big and could pass as a bodyguard, who could get the accent right, not just a Southern accent, but a 19th century Southern accent. And ideally, he should look like a bodyguard and sing. And if possible, in our wildest dreams, he could also play the banjo. And Lee could do all those things. So it was just incredible. The guy playing the banjo in the movie is Lee Coco himself as Lamon, and in the soundtrack as well. And you know, and he really committed to the part, which I really challenged him because I said, you know, the thing about both Lincoln and Lamon is they're very human, they're very real. This is how they were, but they were also bigger than life. Lincoln was always bigger than life. He was the entertainment in Illinois when they would, you know, sort of ride the circuit together and come to little towns and entertain the townspeople before, you know, representing them in court the next day. And Lamon was this big impresario character who once won a racehorse in a poker game and created a carnival just so that he could have a race to put the horse in, you know. Even in their own lives and in their own time, they knew that they were bigger than life and they were the center of attention. And so the acting style of the movie is a little bit theatrical and a little bit bigger than life, you know, by design, because that's the only way that you could really capture Lincoln and Lamon, the true Lincoln and Lamon.
And one of the scenes that really stands out when you're talking about those pictures is when the president is giving his Cetron inaugural address, which is considered by many to be one of the greatest inaugural addresses ever. And so it looks great from what I remember seeing last night. Now, Nina, let me ask you a question. As far as, and I'm not being sexist here, pardon me if I'd come across that way. Tell me a little bit about how Mary was cast, because Mrs. Lincoln has always been, unfortunately, as you know, a woman who was very controlling, very moody, crazy in some instances, but Abraham Lincoln adored her. Now, in this movie, she comes across a little bit, for lack of a better word, nicer.
Yeah, it was important to me to kind of rehabilitate Mary's reputation. I have my own personal connection with Mary Lincoln, which is that when I was a kid, I was looking at one of these things, you know, who shares your birthday? And I found out that Mary Lincoln, wife of the 16th president, and I have the same birthday. So ever since then, I kind of had a soft spot for her. And once we started researching this movie, I quickly realized that she really got a bad rap, both in her own time and since kind of in the pages of history. First of all, she also, like Lamon, she was Southern herself. And she was raised in Kentucky with slaves. From a young age, she felt strongly that slavery was a repulsive moral wrong that she couldn't bear. She got out of Kentucky and moved up to Illinois to live with her sister. But she was the abolitionist in the family in terms of the Lincolns. But as a Southerner in the White House, she was a lot really hated, distrusted. People called her a spy. She didn't fit in with the refined world of Washington. And, you know, she also suffered, first of all, from horrible, crippling migraine headaches that there was no painkiller then. She would just have to retreat to a dark room for a day or two. You start to realize, so she had terrible headaches. She was hated, despised, and accused of being a spy during the White House years. She lost two children, and then, of course, her husband. But so given all that, and then when you start to learn more about her, she was incredibly intelligent, she was funny, she was kind, and she had and all of the challenges kind of pushed her over the edge into mental illness. And I think now there's a lot more compassion towards people who suffer loss and suffer mental breakdowns, are in pain. And in those days, people just judged her. And if she wasn't herself at a soiree, that, you know, they accused her of being snotty or you know, mean or not caring, maybe she was really in terrible pain. So, you know, when we first cast Penelope Miller to play the role, my first reaction was, well, she's, you know, with all due respect to Mary Lincoln, who, as I just said, I love, you know, she was rather on the stout side. And Penelope's so slim and pretty, I wasn't sure she was going to pull it off. But she just also, like Tom, completely delved into the research, talked to me at length, talked to various Mary Lincoln experts, scholars, impersonators, etc. And she came to love Mary, too. And so I think she really did bring the human side and help us understand, no, she wasn't just the shrew that you're used to hearing about. She was a real person. There was a reason her husband loved her. She was a really good person. She also did quite a lot of work on behalf of the freed slaves, on behalf of wounded soldiers, you know, but she didn't call the newspapers or, you know, get the newspapers to cover those stories. So behind the scenes, she was a very different Mary than the Mary that people of her time and our time know. So we did really try to show a little bit of a softer side.
And with chemistry, I mean, when you say that Lincoln adored her, it was a romantic love, and that's very important to us, you know, that they were a romantic couple.
Give us the websites where people can go to see the trailer and find out more about how they can view. I know they can download it on iTunes.
Yes, so you can see the trailer and learn more about the film at savinglincoln.com. You can watch the movie right now at iTunes. We're exclusively at iTunes for just a few more weeks. Then the DVD will come out. And also, there's something really awesome going on right now, which is we're working with a company called Tug, T-U-G-G.com, Tug.com. You can find Saving Lincoln there. The best way to see Saving Lincoln is on the big screen. I know there's people in your audience who would love to see the story of Abraham Lincoln leading the nation through the Civil War, and you can bring Saving Lincoln to El Paso. You have to be a sort of person with a personality. You create a screening. It happens at any big movie theater that you choose, you know, AMC, Regal, Edwards, whatever your big chain is there. You get a date set up. It goes on their website. And then if enough people buy a ticket, by you telling your friends, your local organizations, et cetera, 60, 70 people is the minimum, then the screening becomes a green light, and it's a go. And it'll happen, you know, in your community, so your community can see it on the big screen. So,
and you get a cut of the proceeds.
Yeah, so. The person who organizes it gets 5% of the ticket sales. So it's a great deal for everybody. I want somebody in El Paso to bring Saving Lincoln to El Paso on Tug.com.
Well, thank you very much. We've been visiting with Nina and Sal Litvak. They are with Saving Lincoln, and savinglincoln.com is the address that you would go to find out more about it. Thank you all very much for being with us here.
Oh, thank you so much, Louis.
It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Science.